Now that there is at least an official ceasefire in Gaza, many observers have noticed that Israel appears to be turning its attention more and more toward the West Bank. Secretary of State Marco Rubio recently lifted sanctions that had been imposed on violent West Bank Israeli settlers. And Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has said that Israel is a step away from annexing the Palestinian territory. Anel Shelain is a research fellow for the Middle East at the Quincy Institute, who resigned from the State Department over what she called former President Biden's unconscionable Gaza policy. She spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg.
Let me first ask you, when you did resign over the Gaza policy, what was the reaction from your colleagues?
It was interesting because I had left, I had emailed several colleagues just letting them know I was resigning over Gaza and had given them a personal email address where they could reach me if they so desired, since obviously my State Department email address was not going to work anymore. And several colleagues did reach out to express their support and their gratitude. That ended fairly quickly. I assume, and my understanding from friends is the message from higher up was clear that what I had done was inappropriate, and the State Department does not condone people going public. You know, public resignations are not sort of in the mode of the State Department, where you have access to this classified information and you also have the dissent channel. And so the idea is that you should express your dissent internally, and that it's out of keeping with the character of someone serving in the State Department to sort of go public and splash something like this across the headlines.
And so there was some internal discussion before you left, right? Not just from yourself, but from others, would you say?
Oh, certainly. I was part of very active groups within State Department. Many of us were just connected over signal threads. These were not necessarily people who were in person communicating, but there was a significant amount of distress and shock at what the Biden administration was facilitating and supporting and directly enabling. And, you know, I had made it known that I was going to be resigning in protest, but I hadn't initially planned to go public with the resignation. I hadn't been at the State Department for very long, and I didn't think that anyone would care that I was opposed to this policy. But it was colleagues at State who said, please go public with your resignation. And so I decided I would. And it did end up getting more attention than I would have expected.
I guess along with all the other resignations from the State Department and the UN, for that matter.
Well, yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, the very first resignation was Josh Paul, who resigned within weeks of October 7th, who I very much commend. And I had been in touch with Josh before I resigned, just letting him know that I was also going to be resigning. And at the time that I resigned, there were three of us. So it was Josh and then Tara Kabash, who is Palestinian American, who resigned from the Department of Education. And then I resigned. And then following that, you saw several additional people resigning publicly, but many others have also resigned privately. They haven't necessarily gone public with it, but they have decided they could no longer be part of what the government was doing.
Did you get the impression that the higher-ups in the U.S. government are actually in favor of what the Israelis are doing or have done, and that they feel compelled to make public statements suggesting otherwise, that they're concerned about the humanitarian crisis, but really they do like the idea of the Israelis clearing out Gaza, so to speak?
I think it depends who we're speaking of. Obviously, the U.S. government is vast, and there are many people in senior positions who may have privately disagreed, but did not go so far as to speak out against it. But I do think, obviously, it's clear that those who were in the direct decision-making role on this policy, so people from the National Security Council, in particular people like Brett McGurk or Jake Sullivan, Amos Hochstein, and obviously President Biden himself, were all supportive. And what's been interesting is to observe in the past few weeks, in the waning days of the Biden administration, as you had several of these officials try to portray what they had done in a positive light, and often receiving some pushback that their legacy will be genocide. And instead, they're trying to make the argument that this has been to US benefit, that the reduction in the strength of Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran is all something that the US should celebrate. I think, contrary to that, the real effect has been an extreme undermining of the US leadership on the global stage. And any pretension the US had to uphold international law or to be an advocate for human rights or to try to hold other countries accountable on concerns of international law or human rights has been completely destroyed. And so in the longer run, I do think that the level of damage done to America's reputation and the way other countries view America is far more significant than any sort of nominal reduction in the numbers of Hamas, given in particular that Blinken himself acknowledged that recruitment for Hamas is higher now than before October 7th. So their narrative that this has somehow made sort of advanced U.S. interests in the region, I think is truly flawed, given the level of instability we've observed, given the way that the U.S. has had to bulk up its force posture in the Middle East at a time when many security experts are arguing that the Middle East really is not such a crucial arena or region for the U.S. to focus so many resources or so much attention on. You know, I think these are our officials trying to launder their legacy, and I don't think they'll be successful in the long run.
So now we're in the ceasefire phase in Gaza, or so-called ceasefire. And do you think that there was a kind of a deal made when Trump came in that he was communicating with the Israeli leaders and saying that, okay, we could have this ceasefire, but you could do whatever you want in the West Bank? And besides, the ceasefire may not last.
I mean, that certainly seems to be how Netanyahu and his cohort have taken that. I don't know what I'm hearing from certain people who may or may not have good information here is that Trump did not necessarily explicitly make any sort of quid pro quo, you know, accept a ceasefire in Gaza, but you have open season in the West Bank. They're saying that it's not what he said, but it's regardless of what he said, it seems quite clear that that is how the Israeli government took it. And I do worry very much that from the perspective of the extreme right wing exemplified by Netanyahu's government, that the West Bank is a bigger priority for them anyway. And what's especially alarming is that you hear U.S. officials echoing these extreme right-wing talking points, people from Senator Tom Cotton referring to Judea and Samaria, to use sort of Israel's preferred word for the words for the West Bank. But even people like former President Bill Clinton used the words Judea and Samaria to refer to the West Bank. And this was obviously the president responsible for the Oslo Accords and this ostensible pathway towards a future Palestinian state, which I think just makes clear how deceptive Oslo was all along, since clearly the United States did not use any pressure to actually ensure that Israel pushed forwards towards the establishment of a Palestinian state. So I do worry that the ceasefire is not likely to last in Gaza, and that you now have the transfer of a lot of Israel's attention to this increased level of violence and displacement in the West Bank.
Yeah, it does seem like Israeli officials, or some of them, have made clear that even if they allow the ceasefire to go on for as long as it's supposed to, they'd like to resume the war. And I don't know what Trump's reaction to that would be, but he sometimes refers to, we have to end these stupid wars, whether he's talking about Ukraine or Israel-Gaza. And so you wonder whether he'll just get impatient and try to do something to end it. Do you get that sense? Or does he just not care? Is he so locked in with the Israeli position?
I mean, it's very hard to know. Obviously, I think there was a lot of concern based on Trump's picks for his various cabinet appointments, many of whom are extremely anti-Palestine, very pro-Israel. Obviously, people like Mike Huckabee, who denies the idea of the existence of a state of the existence of the Palestinians. And Elise Stefanik for UN ambassador. At the same time, What I've heard is these were selections made to appease major donors, people like Miriam Adelson, who's provided hundreds of millions of dollars to both this recent campaign and Trump's previous campaigns, who very much supports Israel annexing the West Bank. But at the same time, there are also, we know that Trump fancies himself the ultimate deal maker, that he sees it as his right to win a Nobel Peace Prize, the same way President Obama and President Carter did, and some kind of resolution to the conflict would perhaps justify him winning a peace prize if it was in fact a true resolution. I know he has his eye on Israeli-Saudi normalization, and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia has been very clear that that will not happen without the establishment of a state of Palestine, although I think he may have been staking out that position. I don't know that he will necessarily adhere to that. He may be willing to be satisfied by some sort of nominal process, something similar to Oslo, where neither Israel nor the United States has any intention to actually make progress towards the establishment of a state of Palestine, but that the Saudis would be able to say that they made some progress there.
And Trump has also spoken about Gaza as a prime real estate territory, I guess.
Exactly.
His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, would that be something that would suggest he would go along with what the Israelis want to do, or would it be something that he could sell as a way of helping Palestinians as well?
I mean, you're not wrong that he has described Gaza in those terms, as has Jared Kushner. Again, it's just very hard to know like what exactly his plans are there. I think, you know, what we can be sure of is that Trump is not interested in being seen as weak, the way Biden was seen as just bowing to Netanyahu and giving him whatever he wanted, even when he repeatedly broke these so-called red lines that Biden tried to establish. And so I don't think we're going to see Netanyahu being able to push Trump around the same way he could push Biden around. But that being said, I also don't think that Trump has any sort of commitment to the fate of Palestinians, except insofar as it's a means for him to sort of enhance his own reputation again as this deal maker and peacemaker. I mean, it is encouraging that he has used language around the notion of no new wars, keeping the U.S. out of unnecessary wars, you know, this notion of the American people are tired of wars and want peace. I mean, these are encouraging things for him to say. And I think the reason he says them is because they resonate with many Americans who have seen unnecessary and costly wars, especially in the Middle East. I just hope that he actually implements policies that would facilitate less military engagement and, you know, no getting dragged into a war with Iran, for example, which we know Netanyahu would very much want the United States to fight Iran on Israel's behalf.
Yeah, it seems like Trump is more interested in American companies selling weapons to make money than he is in actually going to war. But we'll see.
Exactly, right. I think Mohammed bin Salman made some eye-popping commitment of $600 billion in investments to the United States, which is, to my understanding, larger than the entire PIF fund that Saudi controls. So it's I think he was perhaps just trying to get Trump's attention. But, you know, we know that the Saudi, the Al Saud and the Trump family have very close ties. And it seems kind of crazy to expect the House of Saud to be an advocate for justice. But I hope that whether it's the UAE or the Saudis, that they may be able to convince Trump that blindly supporting Israeli aggression, whether it's in Lebanon or in Syria or perhaps against Jordan and certainly against the Palestinians, is not in U.S. interests in the long run.
And anything else you'd like to add to what you said?
I mean, I very much hope that the ceasefire lasts. Obviously, I am not optimistic about that, but I very desperately hope it does. But I do worry a little bit about the lack that as the world's attention shifts, and obviously Trump himself loves being the center of attention and is already pursuing lots of different executive orders that are drawing a lot of media attention, that people won't necessarily continue to pay attention to what's happening, even though we know there have already been significant violations of the ceasefire in Gaza, in to say nothing of the escalation of and killing of Palestinians in the West Bank. So while I hope the ceasefire holds, I also worry about people no longer paying attention to what's happening there.
Yeah, it seems like every day we hear the UN Secretary General or some UN official talk about the horrible things that are happening. And, I think they're obligated to make those statements, and I'm sure they sincerely believe in what they're saying. But, the UN is kind of ineffectual when it comes to actually stopping it. So,
Certainly. And we know that Trump is no particular champion of the UN and is already talking about, reforming. I imagine we'll pull out of the UN Human Rights Council as he did before, maybe withdraw US funding for the UN. So yeah, I don't imagine the UN will be made more effective under a Trump presidency.
that's Anel Schelling of the Quincy Institute speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on February 4th, 2025.